Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm joined by my friend and confidant, Jennifer Hashley. Hey, Jen.
Hey, Aaron. How are you doing?
I'm great. Hey, Marathon Monday here in Boston.
And Patriots Day.
Oh, sorry. And Patriots Day, of course.
Yes.
Did you get stuck in any of the traffic?
Not at all, no.
Not bad.
Roads were wide open.
Wide open. Just had to swerve through some runners a little bit here and there. Yeah.
No, I avoided those.
Stay away from them.
I'm pedestrian friendly in my electric vehicle.
Yeah, you are, with those nice license plates on there, too.
Yes.
All right. So, Jennifer Hashley, let's talk about your background for a moment here. Jennifer Hashley started the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project out of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition. It was one of the first initiatives nationwide to help immigrants and refugees develop commercial farming opportunities. Now, 20 years in, Jennifer continues to help farmers excel in the field, and New Entry gives them the tools that they need. It's a revolutionary program that treats sustainable and regenerative farming as jobs creation and economic growth for regions, often in need and stimulus. Additionally, in partnership with her husband, Jennifer runs a diversified pasture-based livestock operation and Pete and Jen's Backyard Birds in Lincoln, Massachusetts.
Lovely Lincoln, home of the Lincoln Minutemen.
I was going to give that to Lexington, but there we go.
They were pretty instrumental. I know we watched the reenactment last evening, Paul Revere and his buddies running around, waking everybody up. Everybody's going to the arms to fight the redcoats.
Yeah, wow.
Pretty exciting stuff.
That is your nugget for Patriots Day right there.
Exactly.
Extending the reach. All right. Hey, Jennifer, I know you don't have to go to the grocery store too often from living on a farm, an active production farm, but did you see last Thursday more than 31,000 Stop and Shop employees went on strike? The employees seek to protect health care coverage. They want wage increases that are in line with regional cost of living inflation, and they want ongoing employee pension plan contributions. And of course, they seek assurance from the parent company against further automation. Now, as it turns out, Stop and Shop isn't just your local New England grocer. Originally launched in Somerville 100 years ago, the organization now maintains 415 stores and 82,000 employees. It's pretty big. It's actually the size of Whole Foods staff. It's twice the size of Wegmans. And since 1995, Stop and Shop has been a wholly owned subsidiary of Dutch international superpower Ahold Delhaize, which maintains large-scale food retail in Europe, South America, and North America. Now, to put some context on this, just before, I want to get your comments on this. So Ahold Delhaize, which is the Dutch company, earned $2 billion in profits last year, and just last week rejected Stop and Shop's employees' demands. The corporate office approved a 11% stakeholder dividend increase. Sounds like it might be some of a shareholder versus your common stakeholder relationship that's getting in the way of actually looking at what's important for a company to thrive and succeed here. So I personally drove by a Stop and Shop, a couple locations this weekend, and there are many folks out there up in arms, blocking parking lots and entryways to stores, and police officers that had to be brought in to protect patrons that were ready to jump the picket line. So recent news segments in our local publications and reporters are saying that there's local politicians, friends, families, community members, maybe even some Teamsters in there that are supporting the employees. And the conceit, the whole narrative is that if you're supporting the local employees, basically you're fighting for a fair wage, a good living for these people, your neighbors. It's a bit of a David and Goliath storyline, and important stuff, right? But Jennifer, my question for you, okay, is what about the folks that are producing our food? Especially those producers in our local communities. What about the New England dairymen and women who can't make a fair living when the fluid milk price is $17 per 100 pounds? They can't go and strike, right? They need to milk their animals. There's no community members petitioning for them. There's no one that they can turn to for demand or pension or a reduction of further automation. So all their support systems continuously promote more automation, and they are looking at a way still of the Earl Butz model of get bigger, get out, right? And if it was the free market or farmers markets that were supposed to balance that out, I'm not sure that's working. Last year, along with price forecasts, AgriMark sent local dairies a list of mental health services and the number for suicide prevention hotline. Okay? So what gives? How can we support our neighbors that are stocking the shelves, but not our local folks actually producing the food? Would this be like boycotting Starbucks because they stopped offering college reimbursement for their baristas, but it's okay to have forego our consciousness for modern slavery in Brazil or child labor of making, actually producing the beans in the Ivory Coast? Where are we at, Jennifer? What do we do with this? That's an easy question. Way up.
I think the thing that comes to mind are the big picture structural questions here. You know, obviously we need to pay the producers a fair cost of production. They have to be able to make a living to stay in business. And I think we also need to enforce our antitrust regulations on the books. I don't know. I feel like everybody thinks the free market should solve everything, but if it's not really a free and fair market, I think that's a challenge. As we've seen all these mergers and consolidation, the bigger and bigger corporations get, the easier and easier it is to squeeze producers down to the race to the bottom of the lowest price for their product. And yeah, who's standing up for them? It's really hard to, like you said, it's hard to organize, it's hard to stand up for yourself, and it's hard when you have a perishable product or you're locked out of a market or you're not big enough to compete and everybody else is getting swallowed up. So I don't know, can we enforce our antitrust laws? Can we look at policies to support producers and consumers? Can consumers vote with their dollar and buy products that are giving back to the producers?
Coaxing more values back into our food system, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, today we can welcome a guest with a unique perspective here, an impressive background fighting for the underrepresented producers throughout the world. In town for a big coffee expo, we welcome the founder of Fair Trade USA, Paul Rice. Hey, Paul, how you doing?
Hey, Aaron. I'm great. Great to be here.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thank you for taking the time.
Happy to.
You had a nice chance to visit with your family.
I did.
Good stuff.
You're awesome. Awesome. So awesome to be back in New England.
Very good. Now, where are you based out of?
Oakland, California.
Oakland, California. And do you travel the world often?
I do. Actually, I just got back from a gathering of social entrepreneurs in Oxford, England, the Skoll World Forum, and just feel so inspired by how many amazing people are out there solving the world's problems. And I come away feeling like basically all of the world's problems have been solved. Now the challenge is, how do we scale up those solutions?
Interesting. So a little bit about your background here, and I'm going to run into some of the conversation lead up to our first question, because I think it's key for our listeners to get an idea of what you've actually been able to accomplish. So Paul Rice is the American president and CEO of Fair Trade USA, the leading third-party certifier of fair trade products in the United States. Since launching Fair Trade USA, which was previously Transfair in 1998, Rice has pushed and maintained the fair trade movement to expand its impact. He has changed hundreds of companies to rework the global supply chain to obtain high-quality products and to support community development and environmental protection. You currently have 800 brands committing to fair trade, over 30. Am I wrong?
You've got old numbers, brother.
Old numbers.
We're up to 1,250 companies and growing. I think we signed four more this week.
Is that right? On the train up here.
have pretty much.
Over 1,200 brands committing to fair trade. That's incredible. And in fact, I read that you've had, and this is probably an old number too, but over £1 billion of coffee under fair trade as well.
Yeah.
So along with coffee, you've got tea, chocolate, honey, spices, sugar, apparel, home goods, and body care. 30 commodities. Incredible. So could you tell our audience why labor concerns halfway around the world are so important to them?
Well, we're all connected, right? You know, the reality is that what we choose to buy, what we choose to eat, has real impact for ourselves, for our health, for our nutrition, and for the health of the world, and for the well-being of millions of farmers and their families around the world who are growing our food. So, you know, just in a very direct way, what we choose to buy and the kinds of products that we, you know, that we choose have a ripple effect on ourselves and on the planet.
I feel like the success of the Fair Trade certification has been huge, obviously, by its growth. And I know it's probably just scratching the tip of the iceberg. now that I feel like in those enlightened consumer movements where people are looking for that or just assume it should be there, what is the next step of that? Does it become a greenwashed thing? How do we make sure that it really upholds its values, I guess, as it grows and scales over time? I don't know. I know you're probably doing a lot on the back end with audits and certifications and things like that, but I feel like there's this inherent suspect these days among the younger generation that anything big and at scale is inherently going to be watered down.
It's a great question. Why don't we come back to that? Why don't we start with the beginning?
Sure.
and talk about what fair trade is.
Please.
So I spent 11 years working with farmers in the mountains of Nicaragua. Fresh out of college, I bought a one-way ticket to Nicaragua. I wanted to go work with farmers, and I signed on to a couple of different international aid-funded projects, all of whom, you know, were well-intentioned, well-funded, and ultimately all of which failed to help farmers in their communities to develop their own capacity to solve their own problems. Despite its good intentions, I think much of the international aid community simply creates dependency on aid. And I grew really disillusioned with that. And kind of by accident, in the summer of 1990, I heard about this crazy group of people that called themselves fair traders. And their slogan was really simple: trade, not aid. Trade, not aid. And their message was, farmers don't need our aid. They just need a fair return for all their hard work and for their great products. And this was a totally new concept to me. I'd never heard of it before. But I started reaching out to some friends in the Agricultural Development Network, and that led me to actually a company here in the Boston area called Equal Exchange, one of the pioneers of fair trade coffee in the United States. And so I wrote them a letter, because this was before internet, and we established a relationship, and I ended up organizing Nicaragua's very first fair trade coffee co-op in 1990. And we sold one container of coffee to Equal Exchange, and they paid us $1.20 a pound for our coffee, which allowed us to give $1 a pound back to our farmers. Here's the punchline: at a time when the local market price was 10 cents a pound, we got our farmers $1 a pound, 10x, 10 times more. To put this in context, most of our farmers had an acre of coffee. Mm-hmm. That's the definition of a small farmer in the coffee industry throughout the world. It's about an acre of coffee, maybe 2 acres. So they were producing on average about 2,000 pounds of coffee a year. You can do the math. 2,000 pounds times 10 cents meant they were looking forward to getting $200 total cash income for the year, not even a dollar a day. Instead, we got them $1 a pound, $2,000. Most people had never seen that much money. I was a very popular guy in the summer of 1990. In fact, my new nickname became Pablo Un Dólar, $1 Paul, because that was our mantra: join the co-op and you get $1 a pound. We organized 3,000 families over the next couple of years into a multi-million dollar coffee export co-op owned by the farmers, selling to fair traders in Europe, because the European fair trade movement was long established and very big. Here in the U.S., there was really nothing, just a couple of companies like Equal Exchange. And so as a result of this direct market connection and a better price for our product, we were able to do remarkable things, like help farmers eat 3 times a day instead of twice a day, like help farmers buy bags of cement so that they could pave the floor of a dirt floor home. We invested in water, we invested in health, we invested in education. We started the first organic certification program in Nicaragua, reforested areas that had been clear-cut for pasture. We organized women's empowerment programs. We built soccer fields. We did all of this stuff in terms of social and economic development, and none of it thanks to any international agency. None of it thanks to the government. It was all thanks to this really simple idea of a fair price for a great product. And so, of course, the invisible dividend of all of this was the hope and the pride and the self-confidence that comes from changing your own life. And in the fair trade movement, we call this empowerment. But it's about hope. It's about feeling like, holy shit, I can make things better for myself. Mm-hmm. And look, I went to Nicaragua during the Sandinista Revolution. I was an anti-capitalist for many years. I thought capitalism was the problem and it needed to be burned down. And through this four-year journey leading this cooperative, I had a transformation. I mean, I think I'm probably a social capitalist now. You know, that's what we're called, social entrepreneurs, people who harness the power of the market to affect social and environmental good. And that's my jam. And that, you know, that four-year experience in Nicaragua changed my life, and it made me want to come back and replicate the fair trade movement here in the U.S. because, like I said, you know, it was big in Europe. It wasn't big here. And that's been my life quest ever since. So what is fair trade? I mean, it's not just a slogan. It's not just a philosophy. It's not just a tagline, trade, not aid. It's also kind of similar to organics, a 200-point checklist of social, labor, and environmental criteria that our farmers have to implement and demonstrate compliance with through an annual audit and certification process. So we have a whole network of field auditors that visit farms and now factories every year, and they verify compliance. And when a farmer meets that high bar of sustainability, when they meet the fair trade standard, then they're allowed to sell to any fair trade buyer in the world with the fair trade label. And the buyers, on their part, agree to pay more money. And that's kind of the secret sauce of fair trade. We don't have a standard that says, you know, meet this high level of social and environmental performance and any costs associated with that are your problem, right? And that's not our model. Our model is the market will reward you for being a better producer. And so the companies, all the brands, now 1,200 companies that we're working with, they all pay above market prices and premiums back to the growers in order to not only pay for the cost of being a fair trade certified production unit, but also to provide vitally important community development funds that make education and health care and decent housing a reality in communities around the world. Sorry for the long speech. I get wound up talking about fair trade.
It was great explanation. And I think it's essential that we all know. And I think we've become more aware that brands now have a certain level of reputational risk with their sourcing claims. A positive influence like you that comes in and does the due diligence gives this brand an opportunity to put themselves in an upper echelon, differentiating production for elevated standard food. But I'm sure in the 1990s, when you started this, it was a far and few between that you could actually make that approach to, that pitch to. How did you get the first few folks to join up and realize that, wow, there's a competitive advantage here?
Yeah. You know, it was tough in the early years. So I moved back to the States in 94. I got an MBA. I wanted to beef up my toolbox, and then I launched Fairtrade USA in 1998. As you pointed out earlier, it was called Transfer USA originally. And in those early years, Aaron, no one in industry, really, certainly no one in mainstream industry, believed that consumers here in the United States would pay a penny or two more for a cup of coffee that helped some farmer halfway across the world. I mean, they slammed doors in our faces. They said, this will never work. And so those early pioneers were, as you might guess, because we've seen this replicated in organics, we've seen it replicating in regenerative, the early pioneers were business leaders who believed that their companies were instruments of good, first and foremost, that their companies needed to create purpose, that needed to create triple bottom line results, and financial concerns were less important to them than demonstrating that fair trade could work. And they went out and they made it work. They educated consumers. They created responsible, transparent supply chains. They made fair trade work, and they proved that you could make money with fair trade. And so then, of course, then companies started to follow because they didn't want to get left out. And so we started a mainstream very early on. You know, we launched in 98. By 2001, we had signed Starbucks. By 2003, we had signed Dunkin' Donuts. And so, you know, the movement started to grow in each product category. We started with coffee, and then we went to tea and chocolate and bananas. And in each product category, it was kind of the pioneers in that category, you know, almost always organic brands who came to us and said, we think organics and fair trade go well together. We think our consumers want this. And we're going to tell them why they want it, and we're going to build this market with you. And so then that created a ripple effect and a kind of competitive dynamic. But here's what I think has changed fundamentally in the landscape over the last 20 years. This notion of sustainable supply chains and more sustainable sourcing practices is being recognized by companies of all sizes in all market segments as a way to create shared value. Michael Porter here at Harvard writes about shared value, the notion that we shouldn't be fighting over a fixed pie. That's the old trade-off mentality of the past. The pie can grow. Sustainability can grow the pie and create value for the companies, for the consumers, and for the workers and farmers in the supply chain, and for the ecosystem. And we don't need to have this trade-off or redistributive mentality. We need to have a mentality of growth through sustainable business models. And I think that's what I'm seeing in the industry today, that a growing number of hard-boiled capitalist business executives are realizing that fair trade and things like it that bring greater transparency to the supply chain, that bring greater storytelling opportunities to the brand side. Those are the wave of the future. Those are the models that are going to make them successful 10, 20, and 30 years out. And millennials are making it happen. Gen Z kids are making it happen. They're demanding that companies do better.
Yeah. What I find intriguing by that, no doubt, is they also are coaxing along their parents and grandparents in that conversation, too. Your best advocates can be some of your own kids explaining to you the value of investing in better quality food for yourself or socially responsible food. And, you know, one thing I, as you were speaking of the fact, and I think I've seen some T-shirts down in Nicaragua with your face on it, actually. So, anyway, but I would guess that you're down there and...
You're embarrassing me now. That's not me. That's Che Guevara.
Oh, that's who it was. I thought it was somebody else. Sorry. I think it would be good for people to understand that now what the problem seems to be, or some of the problem, is we don't have enough supply for where the demand's going. And I think what you established there was if you're taking someone from, you know, tenfold, 10x of what they're getting for total revenue, and you're not just improving their life and their quality, but you're doing capacity building at that point, right? I mean, you're building an infrastructure to actually service the more demand that's coming down the pipeline.
Yeah.
How did you see that? Or at what point did you see that come full circle?
Well, honestly, I think we kind of fell into a lot of the programs that we do at Fairtrade USA. By the way, Fairtrade USA, the organization that I started 20 years ago, is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And our mission is to fight poverty and promote sustainable development. And we're going to change the mission statement to put the word regenerative into it eventually. But suffice to say, that's our mission. And the way we do it is through the market. So we develop standards. We verify, audit, and certify against those standards. We also invest in consumer activation. And we work with farmers and worker groups around the world and build capacity. So we're really taking an end-to-end view of the supply chain and how to make it more transparent, traceable, sustainable, and responsible. We started kind of assuming, oh, the farmers will simply respond to the signal. If they're going to get 10 times more money for their coffee through fair trade, they'll just listen to the market saying produce higher quality, deliver on time, and they would, you know, invest in developing those capacities themselves, business capacity, quality, and so on. Going organics, reforesting, like all of those are, we thought, responses to market signals, and that the thing to do was to disintermediate the supply chain and get the farmers more connected to the end buyer, kind of like a farmer's market gone global. It didn't actually happen that way. A lot of farmers simply didn't have the wherewithal, even once they were plugged into the market, to realize, you know, the $50,000 investment in a cupping lab and in training farmers around quality would pay off millions of dollars over time in quality premiums, right? They were just looking at the $50,000. You know, we're talking about poor people sitting on the boards of farmer co-ops,
yeah,
not really understanding kind of the transcendental impact that an investment like that could have. So we did a lot of training early on around quality. Because what the industry was saying early on was, oh, fair trade sucks. The quality of fair trade products sucks. So it's fair trade is just charity for farmers that can't produce quality. So we needed to dispel that myth in coffee, in tea, in cacao, in a lot of these commodities. We needed to dispel the myth that fair trade farmers can't go toe-to-toe with some plantation owner and produce the same quality and be just as responsible in terms of business practices. So a lot of training. And, you know, I just came from the annual specialty coffee trade show, which was here in Boston over the last 4 or 5 days. And many of the winners of a competition, a global competition called Cup of Excellence, and it's run in all of the different coffee producing countries every year. So many of the different winners from around the world this year were fair trade groups. So, I mean, they've totally proven that fair trade groups can produce the highest quality products as well. And in fact, I think the consumer knows there's a logic there, which is you get what you pay for. If farmers get a low price, they're not going to have the resources to invest in quality. If you want quality, you need to pay for it. And for us as a consumer, I mean, the difference between fair trade and non-fair trade by the cup is 2 cents. Yeah. Right, that's really what we're talking about. We're not talking about a huge markup for us, the consumers, to be able to help farmers around the world to keep their kids in school, to grow sustainably, and to lead a better life. But still in the industry, sadly, we're in a situation where only 6% of the market is fair trade, of the coffee market now I'm referring to. And meanwhile, world coffee prices have plummeted and farmers are struggling to survive.
That's amazing to me, Jennifer, because we often use as our pinnacle example coffee for the way to coax values through the supply chain. And the fact that it's only 6% and it's still a commodity where commodity bubbles come into play, and the fact that it's not a preservation from major players like a, you know, like a Starbucks who can be a market maker in themselves, I find that fascinating. But what is our next step then, Paul? What do we do to keep this value chain moving down the line here to get more? Is it we just need more consumers to be willing to appreciate this?
I think first and foremost, it's about consumer activation. I think consumers are hungry for easy ways to make a difference. We are increasingly reading the label.
Yeah.
Whether it's out of health concerns or, you know, nutritional concerns or interest in environmental and social issues. Some people wring their hands and say, oh, the proliferation of labels is too confusing, too many labels. You know, my package, my bar of chocolate looks like a NASCAR, you know, with actually, there's no evidence whatsoever to support the notion that more labels, more consumer education is bad. Right, like these labels are all growing, they're all thriving, consumers are buying more and more sustainable products. I personally think more information is better than less information. And if there are 10 or 20 sustainability labels out there, over time there'll be a consolidation, I'm sure. But in the meantime, consumers have an appetite to know. I mean, you could look at non-GMO and say non-GMO is totally redundant. Organic is already non-GMO. Why do we need non-GMO and organic? And yet non-GMO has taken off and consumers are looking for it. So that for me is, you know, again, just an indication that consumers are the key to this change. And we're in the early stages of what I think is going to be a 20 to 30 year process where the new normal for our kids and their kids is going to be sustainable products that are healthier and better for us and better for the planet.
Jennifer, I think you had a question, but I just want to mention, I think Paul just shared with us the future of marketing for fair trade. It's NASCAR. It's going to be on there.
Exactly.
Big logo right on top.
Love
I like it. It's the new generation of consumers.
I guess some of my questions, as I was thinking about talking about this, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras working with coffee farmers as well. So I saw firsthand kind of the boom and the bust cycle of the commodity prices and what that could do for folks. And I guess, we are also really involved in cooperative organizing and trying to get folks to cooperate. And that's a really tough thing in some cases. Even here in the United States with my own project, trying to form a marketing cooperative here with people that come from other countries and trying to get a better price for their vegetables and just working together is challenging. And people have had, you know, really terrible experiences with, some people have had some terrible experiences with cooperatives and were kind of turned off by it. And how do you overcome that with folks? I think, you know, banding together and bringing people together and shared leadership and sharing resources is an amazing thing when it works well. And how, as you've scaled these over time, do you keep that true sense of cooperative empowerment and engagement so that it doesn't become, you know, the management up here and the actual farm workers down here so that there's not this disconnect?
It's a great question. You know, I would say the co-op movement is in some ways very similar to the broader business community that it's a part of. You know, it's not an island of perfection outside of the realities of capitalism. It's a model of business that exists within capitalism and is impacted by social and cultural norms and historical patterns in the countries where it is. And in some countries, co-ops work really great. Mm-hmm. They're strong, they're vibrant, they're democratic, they're transparent, and they're profitable. And in other countries, they've been used as instruments of political influence, and they don't work so well. Mm-hmm. And in some countries, co-ops have a bad name, and so they call them asociaciones, right? Associations. It's the same idea. You know, mm-hmm. here's the thing. If you're a coffee farmer with 1 acre of land and you stand alone, you're toast.
Right.
You are a victim of middlemen, you're a victim of moneylenders, and you have no chance of rising out of poverty. That's just the reality.
Yeah.
The only chance you have of rising out of poverty is joining together with your neighbors and forming associative businesses, I don't care what you call it, mm-hmm. an associative business that creates scale.
Yeah.
Right? Because with 1 acre of coffee, 2,000 pounds a year, that's you know, that's basically 20 bags of coffee a year. You need 250 bags to fill one container. You need 50 containers to be a profitable business, right? So it, just talking about coffee again. Mm-hmm. So if you band together with a couple of thousand of your neighbors, you can totally redefine your insertion in the global economy. Mm-hmm. Opting out of globalization isn't really an option. We used to think that. I was at the Battle of Seattle. That was a fun idea that we could opt out of globalization. Globalization's here. And those farmers are in the global market. Those farmers that are up on the mountaintop in Nicaragua, they're in the global market. And so the question is, are they in it as passive victims of other more powerful forces? Or are they in the global market as a competitive player that is able to acquire a better price and a better return for their hard work? So, you know, I think co-ops and associations and different, you know, farmer-owned entities are absolutely the way to go. They have problems. You know, there's a whole network out there of fantastic NGOs that are providing services to the co-op movement around business capacity, around internal decision-making. We do a lot of that on our staff as well. We have field operations in 8 countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and where those folks, our trainers, are both training farmers and workers, but also activating other local NGOs who typically can do it even better. And I'm a big believer that, you know, the co-op movement is an important model, not the only model, obviously, but a really important model for just and sustainable rural development, with all its problems, obviously, that still need to be overcome.
So we are in a global commodity market, and much of your focus as an organization has been around the global south, the southern hemisphere, where most of the real egregious labor abuse has been taking place. But increasingly, what I've heard and read, you've had interest in the global north and labor tied to produce and wine and spirits and fisheries and aquaculture. And in fact, I met some of your team at the Seafood Expo North America, which is the second largest seafood show in the world, here in Boston recently. Well, you're celebrating your 5th anniversary of this. So is this just natural progress for you? Is this something that you're getting from demand from both your brands that you're working with and your consumer base? How did this evolve?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I have been in this movement for a long time, and I think my own vision was that fair trade would always be a small market niche. Early on, that was kind of the limit of our imagination. We thought, you know, fair trade was going to be a model that worked between small farmer co-ops that were run well, mm-hmm. and mission-driven companies like Equal Exchange and others like it, Ben & Jerry's and so on. And what we learned along the way was that mainstream companies were seeking similar value in both supply chain security and in brand differentiation. And so we started to scale, we started to expand in different products. But it wasn't until around 2011 that we realized that fair trade could probably be much more of a mainstream phenomenon than we'd ever imagined. And both because of interest by the industry and interest by the consumer. And so in 2011, we declared kind of a new chapter in our journey, which we call Fair Trade for All. And that's our mantra, Fair Trade for All. And it's quite simply just the notion that no farmer, no worker, no family, no matter what they produce, no matter where they live, should be denied access to a movement that stands for fair wages and environmental sustainability. Everyone has a home in our movement. We want an inclusive movement that welcomes all sectors and communities. And that wasn't the case. Historically, fair trade was only for the so-called third world, right? It was this notion of consumers in the wealthy global north helping producers in the more impoverished global south. And there were lots of things that were off limits. And we just decided in 2011, that's bullshit. And fair trade for all is our vision for the future. So we're going to respond to market demand, right? Because there's a world of hurt out there. There's poverty, there's exploitation, there's environmental degradation in every country in the world and in every commodity. So how do we decide what to do? How did we decide to do fish? How did we decide to do apparel? Jen, you're wearing Patagonia. Patagonia is one of our leading brands in apparel. How did we decide to do that? Well, we did it. We decided to go into those product categories based on the market demand. We're a demand-led model of change. So in the case of fish, which you just mentioned, you know, we had major retailers coming to us saying the fishing industry has great standards for environmental stewardship with Marine Stewardship Council, Monterey Bay Aquarium, World Wildlife Fund. There are different models and standards and approaches that are all focused on ocean conservation. No one's looking at labor. And a few years ago, I don't know if you saw it, but the Wall Street Journal and other outlets came out with some exposés on slavery and exploitation in the fishing industry, and no one was working on this. And so 5 years ago, various players in the industry, Safeway and other retailers, came to us and said, hey, we need a model that brings the labor and the social side of sustainability into the fishing industry. So we reached out to the environmental groups. We asked for their permission to come in and join them. They said, come on in. And so today, you'll see increasingly MSC, or Marine Stewardship Council certification and fair trade certification, living together on a package of fish, much the same way you see fair trade and organics living on a package of coffee or a bar of chocolate. So we feel like we're adding value. We're not competing with those early pioneers in sustainability and fishing. And it's really exciting because more and more retailers are starting to adopt this fair trade model. And so our learning along the way was this model that we started for small scale coffee farmers actually can be adapted and applied to completely different industries like the fishing industry or apparel and home goods. So similarly, 7 years ago, we had apparel retailers coming to us and saying, for the last 20 years, we've been doing these codes of conduct. We've been auditing our factories. It's not really working. We know that factories are keeping double books. We know that they've turned duping the auditors into an art form. We don't really know what's happening in the factory. And remember Rana Plaza, 5 years ago, a factory in Bangladesh collapsed, killed 1,300 workers. It was the biggest tragedy in memorable history. And more brands came to us and said, we need fair trade to migrate from food to fashion. And so we tested it. And it worked, and we signed Prana, then we signed Patagonia, then we signed Gap Inc. for the Athleta brand. Last year, we signed up J. Crew. We have fair trade blue jeans in the world now. Meanwhile, home goods came in, furniture, rugs, home furnishings. We're working with Pottery Barn, with West Elm, with Target. So it's really interesting to see kind of the domino effect of change. And look, let me just say this. I don't believe that companies come to us first and foremost out of good values. I think they come to us because they're seeking value generation in the form of more sustainable supply chains and in the form of a brand story. And so that's not a bad thing. I mean, I love working with values-driven companies, right? Like Patagonia. Love it. Yeah. We're kindred spirits. But I want to build a model that is also attractive and appealing to mainstream capitalism that has to report earnings to Wall Street on a quarterly basis. If we can harness that horse, then we can change the world.
With that, because I think all issues of scale have their inherent challenges, how do you keep the price premium a premium as you scale? Because from my perspective, I just worry that the farmers, as this becomes more mainstream, that they're going to get a smaller and smaller share of that. So how do you maintain that so that they can, as inflation and everything else continues to happen, they get that extra dollar a pound, and that dollar still means something to those families?
So I think part of the answer is the standard and the audit process itself. So in our standard, we actually mandate the premium that the brand has to pay back to the farmers. And so, for example, in the case of coffee, because we were talking about coffee, and I need to say this again, coffee prices have hit a 15-year low. Right now in the international market, a pound of coffee is trading for 95 cents. Farmers are making about half that. So think about that. You know, your $10 pound of coffee, or, you know, your $5 latte, which has 2 cents of coffee in it. Like, farmers right now are getting around 60 to 70 cents a pound. That's way below cost of production. It's dire. It is dire. You know, we've got an immigration debate going on in this country, and some people want to build walls. The motivation for immigration in many cases is poverty in the mm-hmm. countries where people live, and coffee is a big part of the story. There's so many people in Latin America who make a living on coffee, and when prices dip and there's no floor, people go to desperate measures. They cut down their shade trees to sell firewood, or they immigrate, and, you know, there are ripple effects to these commodity swings. In the fair trade coffee model, we have a mandatory 20 cents per pound premium. And then in addition to that, we have a price floor of $1.40 a pound. And that $1.40 a pound is based on cost of sustainable production research that we've done that essentially says, you know, on average, a coffee farmer needs $1.40 a pound to be able to produce coffee in a sustainable manner. So adding in the 20 cent premium, the cheapest fair trade coffee in the land is $1.60 a pound back to the co-op. In today's 95 cent a pound market, that's a significant premium. Mm-hmm. So it's not 10x, but it's right. a significant premium, and we audit that. So every year we audit both the transaction between the buyer and seller, and then we audit the co-ops. And we make sure that the money not only got to the co-op, but that it got to the farmers, which kind of speaks to your yeah. earlier question about, well, how do we know that the co-op's working? We look at their books. We look at the General Assembly vote around whether to invest that fair trade premium in health or education or something else. We want to know that the money was well spent, because our promise to consumers is that when you buy this fair trade product, you know farmers are getting a better deal, the farmer.
Yeah.
So we verify that, and we take it very seriously. And, you know, now, today, we're starting to implement technology-based tools to provide even more data around not only compliance with the standard and where the money went, but then the actual, you know, the impact. So we have a platform called Labor Link, which allows us to survey farmers and workers and ask them about the paying price for their coffee and where they spent the premium and what the impact is, and, you know, in the worker situations, what wages they're getting and how they feel about their jobs. And so, you know, technology will enable us to, I like to think of it as crowdsourcing the audit.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, you know, I still think there's a role for independent auditing, but if we can crowdsource the audit, if in real time we can pull data from farmers and workers about how they're doing and how the model is working for them, mm-hmm. then I think we have the ability to continually improve the fair trade model and make sure we're delivering on our promise of better lives for farmers.
Hmm. That's great. When I was in Africa, I saw a lot of new tech companies that were starting up called Farmerline and others that are using cell phone technology to do a lot of technical assistance.
I've heard about Farmerline. They're cool.
They're really cool. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Even doing population census in places where people don't have addresses with, you know, GPS coordinates and biometric data collection and things like that. I feel like that technology is really going to reach the rural community in a way that real-time consumers can link back their cup of coffee directly to where it was grown. GPS coordinates someday.
Yeah, we're close. We're close on that. Yeah. And Fairtrade USA will be investing in that increasingly over the next couple of years. Aaron, I wanted to come back to your question about certifying here in the United States, because in the 20-year history of our organization, we'd never certified anything in the U.S., which is kind of weird because we have the, you know, USA in our name. We're Fairtrade USA, but we never certified U.S. farms or factories.
Right.
We were focused on Africa, Asia, and Latin America. We're in 70 countries working with 1.6 million farmers and their families in coffee and tea and all these other products, but only overseas. So a few years ago, we started to get feedback from both retailers, mainstream grocery stores, and social justice and labor rights organizations that, like, what the hell? Why aren't you guys certifying farms and factories here in the U.S.? Like, we have many of the same issues here in the U.S. in terms of how labor is treated and the return to farmers and so on. You opened the show talking a little bit about dairy, and it's interesting, we're studying dairy now. But suffice to say, we realized it made no sense anymore for us to only work overseas and not to work with the farming community and the farm worker community here in this country. And so 3 years ago, we certified our first farm in the United States, a tomato farm in Arizona. And my team and I just visited them a couple of weeks ago, and they're amazing, and they're doing incredible work. And the fair trade premium is enabling those workers to provide health care for their families, and they're investing in housing. And it's like really cool and inspiring. And so now we're certifying more and more farms. We've certified a couple of fisheries, including, I think, a scallop fishery,
right?
Here in New Bedford, Mass, yeah. Which is totally rad, and a t-shirt factory in L.A. that supplies to Patagonia. But most of the focus has been on ag, and I'm really excited about that because I think, you know, most Americans don't realize the farm worker situation in this country is still really dire. And farm workers, you know, in many cases still kind of live in the shadows and don't really feel like they have any recourse if they don't get the right wages, or if there's sexual harassment on the job, or if they get hurt and don't get taken care of. And so in some ways, fair trade is going to try and fill that void and provide a voluntary model for respecting the rights of workers, right? The voluntary in the sense that the farm owner, if he or she signs up for fair trade, their practices are going to be audited and scrutinized, and they're going to be expected to treat their workers with the kind of dignity that the rule of law should provide, but often doesn't because of the legal status of folks that are picking our fruit and, you know, farming our lands.
Yeah. So we've heard about Fair Trade for All. We've heard about certifying U.S. production for Fair Trade USA. We've heard about MSIs working on multi-stakeholder initiatives. What can we expect to see from you in the next 1 year or 3 years?
So, you know, in terms of new products, I'm really excited to share that just very recently we've started an exploration of certifying dairy in partnership with Chobani. The founder of Chobani, Hamdi Ulukaya, has become a friend, and he's very passionate about issues of worker rights. And of course, Chobani hires refugees, and they've been very outspoken about the refugee issue. And so we're just really proud to work with a values-driven brand like Chobani. And we're doing the feasibility analysis. So I'm not assuming we'll be certifying dairy, but I would like to go into that industry. And you mentioned, you know, the problem with dairy is twofold. You know, it's the price to the farmer and family farmers that are struggling to stay in business and maintain a lifestyle and a culture and tradition in this country that's been around for hundreds of years. And it's also an issue of the farm workers, because all of those farmers hire labor. And the farm workers, I mean, if the farmers are struggling to survive, imagine the farm workers. So we've got our work cut out for us. And, you know, we're going into this with a lot of humility. We don't know the dairy industry. I don't know whether fair trade can add value or help help the industry, but we're really excited to try, and so that may be coming down the pike. And I think what's coming up in the next 3 years. So we just approved a new strategic plan. My board just approved it a few weeks ago. Our strategic vision is, number one, new products, if it makes sense, if there's real value that we can add in terms of both labor rights, social justice, sustainability, and industry interest. There has to be industry interest. We're not going to certify a farm and then like go try and find a buyer for it, right? It really starts with, is there demand for this so that we can enact change in the short term? So we'll definitely go after new opportunities like that. But I think the core focus comes back to this issue of technology and technological transformation. Because my dream is to be able to provide end-to-end supply chain transparency from the farmer to the exporter, importer, brand, and end consumer, from the farmer to the consumer, such that we can see who's growing our food and reach out a helping hand and help. And, you know, fair trade is providing that transparency, but it's not readily available to the consumer. So you'll see our fair trade certified stamp of approval on a package of coffee or a banana or a fair trade certified product. And that's, you know, that's kind of like a good housekeeping seal of approval, right? It's a reassurance to the consumer that, oh, okay, I know I can buy this because it's certified. But that's not an interactive experience. And consumers increasingly want to know more. They want to know who grew that product. Tell me the story. Storytelling is such a powerful part of human behavior. And so how do we make that supply chain truly short? How do we enable us as consumers to friend our farmer? We can do it locally by going to the farmer's market, but how about globally? How do we do that? Technology is going to allow that, and it's here. I mean, I travel all over the world all the time. All of our farmers have cell phones. Like, it's obviously the pace of technological change is such that within the next couple of years, we'll be able to make this dream a reality, and we're really excited about that because we believe at the end of the day that our model of change depends on the consumer, on consumer behavior. And we believe, and I think the research supports this, that consumers are aware, we, the people, are aware of problems like climate change and soil depletion and child labor and slave labor and exploitation. We know that these problems exist in the world, and we kind of feel overwhelmed. Like, what can little old me do? What can I do? How can I help, right? And it's a very disempowering feeling, right? To feel like, okay, deforestation, climate change, exploitation of labor, these are huge problems. I wish I could do something. I can't. And particularly at a time in this country where so many people are disaffected with the political process, I think we're all hungry for simple, easy ways to lift our voice and make a difference. I don't feel like our problem in this country is indifference with the problems of the world. I think it's that people don't know what they can do. And so here's the cool thing. We all eat.
Mm-hmm. Three times a day.
And hopefully. And we all wear clothes, right? Except some crazy neighbors of mine down the street in Berkeley, California. But for the most part, we all wear clothes. And so how cool to make the act of purchasing food and clothing an opportunity to vote with your dollars for a better world. How cool to make something as simple as a daily cup of coffee a chance to reach your hand halfway across the world and help a family keep their kids in school. And that, I think, is part of the traction that fair trade is getting now, is that consumers are realizing that they can change the world just with their shopping habits. And so I think, you know, this technological and communications revolution that we're frankly, and still in the early stages of, is going to make it so much easier for ordinary people like you and me to vote with our dollars for a better world. And it's going to happen. It's absolutely going to happen. I get discouraged in the short term with things like the coffee crisis. I just talked with dozens and dozens of coffee leaders from around the world. They are all really, they're horrified at the human drama, the humanitarian crisis that is in the makings in coffee communities around the world. So in the short term, I get really discouraged and upset. And in the long term, I feel very confident and hopeful because I really feel like the consumer trends and the trends of capitalism in general are going toward a more sustainable business model.
It's the essential time to have good leadership. And I think that's what we have heard today is excellent leadership in moving this forward.
Oh, you're so kind.
And I'll just say that, you know, it's exciting when you're making that transition from making this hitting the cost of a business on insurance and making it more of a provenance and marketing story and making now technology that vehicle to move us forward. So huge progress. Paul, where can we learn more about Fairtrade USA?
Well, you can check out fairtradecertified.org, fairtradecertified.org. And there are lots of resources out there for information on fair trade. I mean, as we discussed earlier, we work with over 1,000 brands, and most of those brands are educating their consumers on their websites. And it's important for us to ask to tell those brands that we really appreciate what they're doing, and it's also important for us to ask them to do more because the brands are really looking to us, the consumers, to, you know, signal to them that we want them to continue doing this. I don't know if you all know, but Dunkin' Donuts used to do fair trade, and then 2 years ago they dropped out of the fair trade program. And when we asked why, they said, "Well, it's more expensive to us, and we don't really feel like our consumers appreciate it or care about the issue." So it just really shows straight up how totally dialed in companies are to their customer base. And, you know, they're listening to their customers. And if we speak up, they will listen and we will make a difference.
Well, Paul Rice, thank you so much for taking the time to share this insight with our listening audience. I learned a great deal. Jennifer?
Absolutely.
Great
yes.
stuff.
Thank you for your pioneering work.
Yeah. So thanks for taking the time. And I appreciate it. I'll just say until next time.
Aaron, thank you. Jennifer, thank you. I really appreciate you helping to get the word out. It's meaningful work, and together we're changing the world. Appreciate it.